Wow, we are so close to the end of the year that I can't believe it.
Tick-tock.
5 p.m. on Friday, and it's a week until Christmas. Still time for American Indie Radio on 90.3 WHPC.
It never stops.
I'm your host, Tom Ryan, my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales Ryan, here as well. And as we've been doing for the entirety of this year, we've been counting our way through a series of shows that we call Transistor Days, playing the best of the top 40 from 1955 until the end of 1969. It's been quite a ride. Today's show is actually show number 52 in this series. So we've completed a year. Within the year, it's pretty much, this series belongs to 2020. Hopefully one of the better things that happened in 2020.
Something to look forward to.
It's also relevant in light of the fact that it's only a week away until Christmas. So we won't be doing this again until for another couple of weeks, maybe even three, because I don't think we'll be doing a show for this on January 1st either. We might be doing some sort of a compilation thing. So this is it until 2021. So let's pick up exactly where we were, where we left off. As I said, it's part 52, and we are up to the spring of 1968. Now, as 1968 unfolded, it looked like it was going to follow the same basic pattern, or at least the same form as 1967, but with a lot less patchouli and oil, and a lot less paisley, too. The whole love and peace thing seemed to have like gone away like really quickly. I mean, here it is, only like February, March of 1968, and that element of the pop charts seems to have been like negated. Judging by the pop charts alone, the Times seemed to be almost straight-laced and conservative. We all know that wasn't true in 1968. But the creativity was still holding very strong. Singles were still giving albums a run for the money. And in terms of longevity, singles might have even had an edge over their long playing competition. So you can make up your own mind regarding that as the show unfolds. But our first track is from the Bee Gees, one of my favorite 60s bands. And to my knowledge, there has never been a singer so effectively and who could so effectively employ tremolo in his voice, as well as Barry Gibb did, especially on this next track called Words. His vocal cords tremble from beginning to end, which lends a brilliant effect to both the theme and the rhythm of the song. Thematically, the quaver in his voice makes him sound as though he's forever on the brink of tears. Rhythmically, it established a 16th note pulse that keeps the song from sinking into a sea of mush. Instead of going, bah, he goes, da, yeah, it's kind of amazing. This effect certainly wasn't lost on the producer, who also mixed the song in a very unique manner. The voice is way out front and center, while the orchestral accompaniment is reduced to a hush. Even when the band is at its loudest, the sound of Gibb's breathing is clearly audible, making this as close to an a cappella performance as one could get without dismissing the musical accompaniment entirety. On American Indie Radio, 90.3 WHPC, here are the Bee Gees with Words.
Smile. An everlasting smile, her smile can bring you near to me. Don't ever let me find you gone, 'cause that would bring a tear to me. This world has lost its glory, let's start a brand new story now. My love, right now, there'll be no other time, and I can show you how, my love. talk in everlasting words and dedicate them all to me. And I will give you all my life. I'm here if you should call to me. You think that I don't even mean a single word I say. It's only words, and words are all I have to take your heart away. You think that I don't even mean a single word I say. It's only words, and words are all I have to take your heart away. It's only words, and words are all I have to take your heart away. It's only words, and words are all I have to take your heart away.
Man, I got to tell you, back then, I was such a fan of Barry Gibb. I loved the Bee Gees so much. But Barry Gibb was definitely one of my heroes in the 60s. I would equate him as high as anybody else who was making music at that point in time for me. It's obvious that, you know, things changed a lot in the 70s. But, you know, good for them that they were able to figure out a way to beat obsolescence. But anyway, I think we might have a pair of great misses in today's show. And next up is one of them, very quickly. One thing that I hate that pop music will do now and then is try to literally emotionally manipulate me. It will want to make me cry or make me feel sad about somebody's death or dying. The whole rock and roll idea of rock and roll, you know, dead songs or death songs. I really had a real problem with all of them. And then at 1968, I think one of the most cloying and obvious examples of it came out. It was actually, I didn't know this, but it was a song that dates all the way back to 1962 from South Africa. It was a hit for a guy named Peter Lotus. But here, it's being revisited by Bobby Goldsboro, not one of my favorite artists.
And thanks for that disclaimer.
This was his only number one hit, but this song sold so well. It was the fastest selling record in the history of United Artists Records. That was the label it was on. It became a gold. It was classified as a gold record in just 2.5 months after its release, which is pretty amazing. Worldwide, it was the best selling song of 1968. Bar none. It sold more copies than Hey Jude by the Beatles. And I hate it because I hate songs that go out of their way to make me feel miserable and make me want to cry for reasons that are just purely usurious. You decide for yourself. On American Radio 90.3 WHPC, here is Bobby Goldsboro with Honey.
See the tree, how big it's grown, but friend, it hasn't been too long. It wasn't big.
I laughed at her and she got mad. The first day that she planted it was just a twig. Then the first snow came and she ran out to brush the snow away so it wouldn't die. Came running in, all excited, slipped and almost hurt herself, and I laughed till I cried. She was always young at heart, kinda dumb and kinda smart, and I loved her so. And I surprised her with a puppy, kept me up all Christmas Eve 2 years ago. And it would sure embarrass her when I came in from working late, 'cause I would know that she'd been sitting there and crying over some sad and silly late, late show. And honey, I miss you, and I'm being good, and I'd love to be with you if only I could. She wrecked the car and she was sad and so afraid that I'd be mad, but what the heck. Though I pretended hard to be, guess you could say she saw through me and hugged my neck. I came home unexpectedly and caught her crying needlessly in the middle of the day. And it was in the early spring when flowers bloom and robins sing, she went away. And honey, I miss you, and I'm being good, and I'd love to be with you if only I could. One day while I was not at home, while she was there and all alone, the angels came. Now all I have is memories of honey, and I wake up nights and call her name. Now my life's an empty stage where honey lived and honey played and love grew up. And a small cloud passes overhead and cries down on the flower bed that honey loved. And see the tree, how big it's grown, but friend, it hasn't been too long, it wasn't big. I laughed at her and she got mad the first day that she planted it.
Okay, I really am. I'm genuinely sorry. I that song is such a drag.
It's schlocky.
It's such a drag. I mean, it really does get under your skin, though, when you're talking about, you know, a husband losing his young wife. And it's just, it's miserable. Rolling Stone readers, and just not too long ago, but 9 years ago, rated that song the second worst song of all time of the 60s. So I'm glad for that. I'm not alone. All right, let's get back on track now. Dan Penn, one of my heroes of all time, and Spooner Oldham deserves the same sort of praise, were two of the most talented songwriters to emerge from the South in the mid-60s. Penn, who is been regarded by no less an authority than Jerry Wexler as one of the finest white soul vocalists around, worked with, sometimes against, Chips Moman at Moman's American Recording Studios in Memphis. Before that, he was a songwriter and engineer at Rick Hall's Fame Recording Studios, the first proper recording studio to hit the rural area of Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Oldham was a session player, an ace songwriter-arranger at Fame, who eventually relocated to American, teaming up with Penn to write songs. Now, Penn and Oldham came across a singer named Alex Chilton when he was only 16 years old. The Box Tops came in for a recording session, and Penn decided to produce them, recording a demo song that was lying around called The Letter. When the record became a number one hit, Penn and Oldham decided they had to get busy. The group's second single, Neon Rainbow, was disappointing, so they decided to write the next song themselves. And this track, Cry Like a Baby, was the sterling result. This record is simply one of the best hybrids of Memphis soul, country, pop, and psychedelia ever concocted. It qualifies as a classic in all four categories and deserves enormous praise for its remarkable craftsmanship and faultless construction. Chilton's vocal is spot on, perfect. His deliberately hoarse and deepened tone was an affectation to make him sound older, and it worked beautifully. But anybody who's familiar with Clinton's later work with Big Star or as a solo act would find it hard to believe that the keening tenor of his natural voice could have been altered so much at such a young age. Fact of the matter is, all that Alex was doing was imitating that fantastic voice of Dan Penn's that Jerry Wexler was talking about. Well, Penn did such a good job on the demo that all that Alex wanted to do is like sound like him. So he changed up the huskiness and added that to his voice. On American Radio, 90.3 WHPC then, here are the Box Tops with Cry Like a Baby. It was pretty awesome because Dan Penn got a song out of the ad lib at the end when he says, "You left the water running. You cried like a baby." And then he wrote a fabulous song that was called "You Left the Water Running."
Which is your theme song.
Yeah, I've actually performed that song a couple of times.
Oh, no, because you always leave the water running.
Oh, that too. You forgot to turn off the directional. That would be another theme song of mine.
Well, that song, Dan Penn needs to write that song.
All right. Time for the Beatles. Lady Madonna would have done practically any band proud. It had intriguing lyrics, construction was impeccable, melody was hummable, and the performance was spot on. For the Beatles, though, it seemed hopelessly retro. With the Baroque construction of most all their record releases since Sgt. Pepper, the Beatles had painted themselves into a corner. How much more complex, layered, and convoluted could they get? Well, chuck all that. They must have thought it's time to chill out and just play. Lady Madonna is a straightforward piano-based composition with the only concession to gimmickry being the late addition of a saxophone quartet. The public must have been initially disappointed because the single rose no higher than number 4. The group's worst chart position for an A-side since 1964, when they had 5 or 6 songs competing against one another. That being said, the other thing that is retro about this song, if you're interested, look up a guy named Humphrey Littleton. We did a show. If you look back at our, if you go to AmericanNetwork.com.
To our archives.
Right. If you go to our archives and you check out for what we did, like you know, England's music before the British invasion.
Like the skiffle bands.
Yeah. All, right. Everything that led up to the British invasion. It was like England before, what did we call it?
What did we call it?
It was called Britain Before the Invasion.
Ah.
And there's a guy whose name was Humphrey Littleton. Humphrey Littleton, and he made recorded a song called Bad Penny Blues. You'd be amazed at how it is a near carbon copy, perfect example of where Paul McCartney kind of lifted the entirety of Lady Madonna, with the exception of the lyrics.
Wow.
On American Radio 90.3 WHBC, here is Lady Madonna. Precise and short, actually, even, too. It's only 2 minutes and 18 seconds. Shortest Beatles single in quite a while.
Yeah.
All right. Back to America. And speaking of superlatives, while at Atlantic Records, Aretha Franklin recorded some of the most important and trend-setting American music of the 20th century. I would say on a par with Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong. I know that might sound over the top, but I think it's really essentially true, because all three artists, with all of them, you can't separate their technical virtuosity from their means of expression. In other words, their greatness cannot be measured simply by their musical talent. Jerry Wexler put it brilliantly in his autobiography called Rhythm and the Blues. He said, "To my way of thinking, there are three qualities that make a great singer: head, heart, and throat. The head is the intelligence, the phrasing. The heart is the emotionality that feeds the flames. The throat is the chops, the voice." Precision of execution, mentally and vocally, or in the case of Ellington and Satchmo, instrumentally, is only good insofar as it communicates to the heart of the listener. Regarding Aretha Franklin, this is so transparent that it is inherently sad. If she so much as attempts to sing something other than what is heartfelt, the result is abject failure. This is quite a burden, for your options are to suffer the pain of endlessly bearing your soul or coasting. And Aretha was certainly not coasting. On American at Radio, 90.3 WHBC, here she is singing Sweet, Sweet Baby, Since You've Been Gone.
Baby, 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 baby.
two killer classics from the spring of 1968. The one thing that I probably could have said at the start of this program is that this exact period of time is really kind of a golden age for Black musicians. So much is happening that is like changing the face of music. Aretha is literally redefining soul music at this point in time. And here's James Brown more or less inventing funk.
Oh, yeah.
As it's happening. It's totally a brand new thing. When the Jackson 5 auditioned for Motown, little Michael, the little 11-year-old, 10-year-old Michael, sang that song for his audition.
Wow.
It's on film. You can see it. It's pretty amazing. That was the track. So, yeah, a lot going on there. And if you really want to talk about change in regarding, you know, Black artists and what was happening in 1968, how about Sly and the Family Stone having their first top 10 hit at this exact point in time? This is a song that pretty much that popularized the band. The song obviously did what it was supposed to do. It launched Sly and the Family Stone into the pop consciousness. But the band themselves sort of thought of it as like, oh, we were just kind of lowballing it. You know, we just wanted to do something that we knew was just going to be popular. We didn't even think it was kind of that good. We just, you know, they thought that they were kind of selling out when they put this song out. Well, man, if this is selling out, then please do it all the time. On American Radio 90.3 WHPC, here's Sly and the Family Stone with Dance to the Music. Thanks for that. Sly and the Family Stone. Okay, since we've been on a soul kick, let's move 180 degrees in the opposite direction. Again, like I'm saying, I don't plan it this way. This is just the way that they fall chronologically. But I want to like talk a little bit to explain this about somebody named Francis James Child. In the time before recorded music, when music, especially folk music, was just something that was handed down generation by generation.
You're talking about the child ballads.
Exactly. There was an Englishman named Francis James Child who collected a lot of the folk songs that were happening in England and the United Kingdom. And he would collect it and write down the information that he had. He'd write down their lyrics. He'd write down the connections from one to another. And they became quite famous. They were known as child ballads because it was really the only history that we had before the time of recording. So it was an amazing thing that he did. Now, child ballad number one and number two both relate to this next track. Ballad number one was called Riddles Wisely Expounded. Ballad number two, child ballad number two, is called The Elfin Knight. And they both contained elements of this song, which oddly enough was recorded back in 1966, which from 1966 to 1968, that's like saying that the song was 100 years old and that recorded before the time of recording. I mean, nothing in 1966 sounded incredibly cool in 1968 because music had changed so much. And yet, a movie came out with this song on its soundtrack called The Graduate, that suddenly launched this song into the top 40, up to number 11, in fact. Simon and Garfunkel performing Scarborough Fair Canticle on American Net Radio, 90.3 WHBC.
Scarborough Fair, parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. Remember me to one who lives there. She once was a true love of mine. Tell her to make me a cambric shirt, a deep forest green, parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme, and snow-crested brown, without no steam or need of work, was the child of a mountain. She'll be a true love of mine. Strands and polishes a gun, she'll be a true love of mine. Tell her to reap it in a sickle mill of blazing in scarlet battalion. Parsley, sage, rosemary, and girls born in the soldiers to kill.
I guess if a song is already 100 years old, it can be timeless.
Yeah.
So from 1966 to 1968, that song survived and became a number 11 hit for Simon and Garfunkel 2 years after it was released. Now, this next track starts with chiming bells and then nearly trips over itself trying to recreate the pastoral atmosphere of their previous hit, which was called Groovin'. But this song still manages to sound every bit as beautiful as the day it describes. The creative and original melody and vocals of Felix Cavalieri and Eddie Brigati can take the lion's share of the credit. Although the Rascals dropped the hard-rocking approach of their early material, they couldn't wash the soul from their singing, which was a good thing. The vocals in particular here make the difference between a good song and a great one. The Rascals were willing to take musical risks, but this was perfectly in keeping with the anything goes atmosphere of the times. They finally and permanently dropped the juvenile Young Rascals tag here as well, so the name would reflect the maturation of their new sound. On American Radio 90.3 WHPC, here are the Rascals with A Beautiful Morning.
It's a beautiful
fabulous record by one of the most interesting bands of the mid-60s era, the Rascals, Young Rascals, whatever you want to call them. Now, this next song is a Motown track, which I don't think most people are aware of the incredibly sad story behind this song. I'm going to play Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing by Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell. Now, when Tammy Terrell arrived at Motown in 1966, she impressed everybody, not only with her voice, but with her infectious, headstrong personality. Marvin Gaye in particular was quite smitten. Although he denied until his death that there was any romantic involvement between them.
It didn't sound like it when they sang together.
Right, exactly. Because the image they portrayed on vinyl was absolute blissful love, right? On vinyl, they were a perfect couple. Gordy assigned Gaye and Terrell to record together with his new songwriting team, Nicholas Ashford and Valerie Simpson. Their first release, Ain't No Mountain High Enough, reached number 17 and established a theme of everlasting love which would appear on virtually all of their subsequent releases. You played that song earlier. Your Precious Love and If I Could Build My Whole World Around You, we featured that one as well, followed, and both songs reached the top 10. Things finally seemed to be going smoothly for Marvin Gaye. However, Terrell was constantly complaining of blinding headaches, and one night while performing on stage in Virginia, she collapsed into Marvin Gaye's arms. Diagnosed with a brain tumor, she became partially paralyzed. When she convalesced, Marvin attempted to honor their obligations by performing solo or sometimes with Barbara Randolph as a replacement. But he was often emotionally unable to even go on stage. Terrell's partial recovery eventually brought her back to the studio in 1968. Ashford and Simpson continued to write love songs for her and Gaye, and they wrote a masterpiece called Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing and You're All I Need to Get By. This time, they also handled the production. Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing was the team's first single since Tammy Terrell's diagnosis with the brain tumor. And it exemplifies everything that was perfect about the Gaye Terrell lineup. Fans who had assumed that Terrell was near death were elated to hear her voice with Gaye, still singing of true love and devotion. But most of us didn't know about this at all. It was mostly secret. It's always a dangerous thing anyway to confuse image with reality, but their performance here is so convincing that it becomes hard to believe Gaye's claim of a platonic relationship. Sadly, Terrell never recovered from her illness. To be mobile, she required crutches, so trips to the studio were often difficult and painful. The illness sometimes caused her to have memory lapses in which she would have trouble even recalling the lyrics to the songs as she was singing them. On March 16, 1970, she passed away. She was 24 years old.
Oh, God, tragedy.
Gaye's grief and heartbreak seemed boundless. They may not have been lovers, but their love for each other was nonetheless for it. Shattered and withdrawn, Gaye vowed to stop performing, a promise that he would keep for 4 years. To date, the emotional passion of the Gaye-Terrell performances remains the yardstick by which all subsequent duets are measured. So far, nobody else has even come close. On American Radio 90.3 WHBC, here are the pros, Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell, with Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing. You can say that twice.
Picture hanging I felt I truly loved. She was everything I'd ever been dreaming of, but she was bad, I didn't know it. Her pretty smile never did show it. All I knew is what I could see, and I knew I wanted her for me. I took her home to Mama. Mama wanted to see my future bride. She looked at us both, and then she called me to her side. She said, son, take time to know her. It's not an overnight plan. Take time to know her. Please don't rush into this thing. But I didn't listen to Mama. I went straight to the church. I just couldn't wait to have a little girl of mine. When I got off from work, the preacher was there, so was my future bride. He looked at us both and then he called me to his side. He said, son, take time to know her. It's not an overnight plan. Better take time to know her. Please, please don't rush into this thing. Well, it looked like everything was gonna turn out all right. And then I came home a little early one night. And there she was, kissing on another man. But I know what Mama meant when she took me by the hand and said, son, take time. It's not an overnight plan. Take time. Please don't rush into this thing. Take time.
The one and only Percy Sledge there singing Take Time to Know Her. A man who I used to think of as a one-hit wonder. And what you got to do is like maybe play more than one song and you realize that you're totally wrong.
Yeah, of course.
But it took me a while because after, you know, when a man loves a woman, I didn't hear much else. And when you just scratch under the surface, you don't even have to go deep. Here's a top 40 song.
Like, there you go.
Written by Steve Davis, a guy who wrote a bunch of country songs for other people, but none of them as famous or as well known as Take Time to Know Her. All right, we're going to end on a great miss. I don't like to do that, but this is awesome because it's so over the top. There's two things that make me really want to hate a song right off the bat. One is if it's a death song, which we already heard earlier in the show. The other one is if the songwriter or the performer take the emotionality of whatever the song is about and take it so far that it becomes literally histrionic and hysterical. It sounds like somebody's going to bust a vein in their forehead and their head's going to explode. This is that sort of song, which is kind of what's awesome about it at the same time. Tom Jones performing Delilah on American Radio 90.3 WHBC. Merry Christmas, everybody. We'll see you in 2021. Here's to a much better year coming up. Take care now. Bye-bye.
I saw the light on the night that I passed by her window. I saw the flickering shadows of love on her blind. She was my woman. As she deceived me, I watched and went out of my mind. could see that girl was no good for me. But I was lost like a slave that no man could free. At break of day, when that man drove away, I was waiting. I crossed the street to her house and she opened the door. She stood there laughing. I felt the knife